Ladies and gentlemen, welcome this evening to this Temenos lecture. The title is The Brightest Heaven of Invention, Patterns of Love and Justice in Shakespeare's History Plays. My name is David Brazier, and I'm fortunate enough in my day job to be headmaster of St James Senior Boys School in Ashford in Surrey. It's a double honour for me this evening because I remember many, many years ago when Temenos started, sitting where you are now and watching Kathleen Rain light the candle, and I'm going to light it in a minute. So the fact that I'm standing here doing this all these years later is really quite humbling and rather a special honour for me. So it's very, very special. My second honour is to introduce our speaker, Valentine Jolier. Valentine, you've probably read the read-up on Valentine if you don't know him. He was educated at the Krishnamurti School at Brockwood Park. He is a musician, he is a poet, a playwright, and for me, luckily for the last 2 years, he's been one of my English teachers at St James Senior Boys School. I think one of the things that perhaps we often talk about is how love of if you do not love a subject, it will not open up to you. Its meaning will be closed to you. You must love that which you study. And we both of us love passionately poetry, and we particularly love Shakespeare. And I have to say, any opportunity I get to sit in on Valentine's Shakespeare classes at St James or his philosophy classes is one I readily take. He has, I believe, a profound understanding of the poetic imagination, and I think that's really relevant and important at this time. But enough from me. I will light the candle and remember Kathleen from all those years ago, and I'm sure that we will have a lovely evening. We'll have some questions at the end, but I'm going to ask you not to make statements, but to actually engage with what he said and really ask questions. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Beautifully said. Well, it's so lovely to see so many friendly faces. Kind of gladdens the heart, and hopefully it's going to make what I have to say come out of my mouth even more smoothly. But that's not to say you have to give me an easy time. You know, if there are some things that are unclear, we can open them up and think about them together in the 5 or 10 minutes that we'll have at the end of the lecture. I must get on because I've got a lot to say. I mean, as David said so well, we're both passionate about Shakespeare. I have an unconditional love with Shakespeare. And unconditional love means that even what you don't love, you love. Or you love it knowing that someday you will love it. You don't know it yet, but someday you will. And that has been my relationship with Shakespeare's history plays. I've always been drawn to the comedies and the tragedies and the poetry. But the histories have always left me a little bit cold. Why all this to do with Kings of England? I mean, there are 10 plays out of 37 that have to do with this chronicle. And it's always struck me as sort of rather jarring with the... that's Shakespeare telling me that I'm getting it wrong already, see? So it's always struck me as something a little bit out of tune with the poetic spirit in Shakespeare, until I realized that actually it's perhaps we, or certainly myself, that have it slightly wrong when we think about history. We sort of eliminate a dimension of history that Shakespeare was acutely aware of. And I think for Shakespeare and the poets of his time, history and the poetic, or the poetic imagination, had a point of contact, just as myth and story have a point of contact, or poetry and prose, or narrative and historical event or fact have a point in which they meet. And of course, it's a result of, you know, after the 19th century, a kind of revolution in the way that we think about history, that we've eliminated, we've become suspicious of the myth and tried to concentrate on just the historical events. But from the poetic point of view, this is missing something rather crucial. And so Shakespeare, I'm learning, and I've hopefully learnt a little bit, is looking at history from with an imaginative eye. Not, I don't mean making things up, but I do mean showing what the poetic imagination can show about history. And as usual in Shakespeare, there's always a line in Shakespeare that can kind of communicate this much better than I can. So there's a line which you all have in your, on your handouts. The first couple of lines that I've got for you there, which are from Henry V, from one of the prologues, one of the acts, where there's this little bit of advice to his audience, where he says, "Yet sit and see, or stand and see if you're one of the groundlings, minding true things by what their mockeries be." So I really like this usage of the mind as a verb here. It's minding. I mean, these days we use it sort of kind of in a slightly negative way. So do you mind? But here, minding true things is really very much the sense of minding something forth, bringing something forth from the intelligible world, from the imaginative world, the poetic world. So you contribute as an audience, if you're attentive and you hear the poetry, you mind forth true things, and that those true things meet the mockeries on the stage. And the mockeries, again, is not a pejorative word. The mockeries are to be understood in the sense of figures or images. So what's happening on stage is a sort of, is a figure or a kind of, yeah, so a sort of representation of the true things that you mind forth. So meeting the mockeries and the mind is what we really ought to be doing as an audience. I mean, this is Shakespeare's advice to us. But it is also what the poet does, and especially what the poet does when looking at history. And in this, we can turn to, I mean, it was very, a kind of very common thought in the poetics of the time. If you look at Philip Sidney and his wonderful Defense of Poetry, which was the poetic manifesto of the time, sort of defending poets, and very much giving the sense that poets were up to something quite magnificent. And for Sidney, of course, the poet is greater than both the historian and the philosopher. So I'm sorry if there are any historians or philosophers in the room, you can leave now. But no, don't leave, because you participate in the poetic imagination as far as Shakespeare is concerned. But in the sense that Sidney describes, the historians are always concerned with the mockeries. They're always concerned with the events and the causes and the sort of chain of events that produce historical moments and the great characters of history and that sort of thing. But their concern is chiefly with the particulars of history, and that's their sort of field of study, and that's great. And then on the other side, you've got the philosophers who are thinking about the principles of things and the essence of things and the great universal ideas which are so fascinating in their own right. So therefore, says Sidney, it's not me, it's Sidney, says the philosopher become too concerned with abstractions, and their language is arcane and difficult to understand. So who can bring these two things up together, the particulars and the universals, bring them up using both history and philosophy and transcending both? Sidney's answer is the poet. So the beauty of the poet is that he expresses the universals by means of putting forth real particulars on stage, right? And, you know, if you think about, you know, Richard II or Julius Caesar, they're real characters. They're very much there with us. We can connect with them. But at the same time, history has to serve the universal, right? So it's not just telling historical events, it's historical events at the service of the poetic imagination. So that's the sort of classical tradition of poetics that Shakespeare, my suggestion is, that Shakespeare was writing within that. But he was also, as a Western poet, very much connected to another way of doing history, which is the Christian way of doing history, which has been called, for want of a better term, I think, salvation history. But I'm not suggesting that Shakespeare is doing a sort of a Christian apologetics on stage or trying to sell some kind of particular theology. I think there's something much subtler than that going on. But he's certainly articulating his vision within this sort of mass of patterns and myths and narratives and imagery and teachings that constitute the great Christian myth, as it were, the great Christian narrative. These symbols are, you know, second-hand material, not second-hand in the sense that they're not first-hand, but in the sense that he's so used to working with them. So those are the images he works with all the time. And so thinking about that, I want to turn briefly to an idea that I got from my new hero, Northrop Frye, the great Canadian literary critic. He's absolutely wonderful. I love him. And particularly his book on the Bible and literature, which is called The Great Code. I really recommend that book if you haven't already seen it, in which he describes this shape, which he suggests is, in fact, the shape of the myth in the Bible, or the shape of the story in the Bible, which is a sort of a recurring narrative that happens time and time again in the stories. And really, the shape, he says, is shaped as a U, and it's a narrative of, well, we have an original state of bliss or innocence, a kind of harmony in which human beings and the divine are connected. Then there's a decision of the heart, which provokes a rupture away from this original state of innocence. So it's a decision of the heart, a lack of faith, a turning away, and the turning away results in some kind of exile. And so the exile leads, whether it's Adam and Eve or Adam and Eve's family or a people, in the case of Israel, leads away from the primordial innocence into the opposite to the blissful state, a kind of parody of the blissful state, which is, in biblical terms, the wilderness or the desert or Egypt or Babylon or Rome. Every time there's a sense of the people have been led from innocence and bliss to bondage and slavery and alienation and a state where there is no harmony amongst the people. Now, what is it that can turn that around? In the biblical narrative, it's always, Frye suggests, a kind of leader whose heart has been turned back to the divine and therefore is somehow driven by justice. Right? The biblical word is righteousness, but that's the biblical word for justice. And so through this kind of sense of justice, he's able to lead the people from the state of alienation back to a state of harmony or bliss, which is the same yet different. So it's not just going back to paradise at the beginning. It's another promised land. So there's a kind of, as it were, there's a kind of reversal of energy that happens in history, where things seem to have taken a turn for the worse and we're in a state of complete wilderness or alienation or disharmony. And there's somehow an energy that can turn this around. And if we just look at Northrop Frye's few words about that, I think they'll help us. So this is a sequence of muthoi, he says, only indirectly of historical events. And our first step is to realize that all the high points and all the low points are metaphorically related to one another. That is, the Garden of Eden, Promised Land, Jerusalem, Mount Zion are interchangeable synonyms for the home of the soul. I'm very much interested in that with regards to the narrative of the history of England, right? Can a society, can a land, a people, become a home for the soul, right? Because as you can see, that symbol is different every time, but metaphorically has the same purchase, right? So the home of the soul is not just the home of the soul within, but also the home of the soul as a sort of community of human beings. So, and to conclude with that, and in Christian imagery, they're all identical with the kingdom of God spoken of by Jesus. Similarly, so that's at the bottom of the U shape, you've got Egypt, Babylon, and Rome are all spiritually the same place. And the deliverers of Israel, Abraham, Moses, and Joshua, the judges, are all prototypes of the Messiah, or final deliverer. Right? So we've got this U shape, which is, of course, a comedic shape. It's the shape of comedy. So in the sense of there is something that turns around a narrative that is going to go wrong. And of course, the thing that turns that around in the Christian narrative is love. The central message of the Christian myth is love. Love is the one quality, the one energy that can reverse the whole process back to the symbol of the promised land. Of course, one of the symbols that is attached to love in the Christian sense is the miracle birth. And I really like this symbol with regards to history, because a miracle birth is something completely unexpected. So it is not caused by history, in other words, and it is not bound by history. It's an energy of a completely, radically different order that interrupts the course of history and can revert it. Right? And this works in Shakespeare's comedies, as well as, I hope to show you tonight, in the tragedies. But the point is, Shakespeare isn't really interested in anything else. It's either love or nothing, really, ultimately. That's the one thing that can change things. So at the end of the U-shape, if we think about the home of the soul, as England being the home of the soul, we've got this second bliss, which is, and I like this quote from the Bible, from Isaiah, which is actually not my favorite book, but this quote is particularly good in describing this sense of newfound unity. You don't have it. I'll just read it out to you. But it's a famous quote. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. Right? So this is a natural and social order of being in which all the traditional categories of conflict which fuel history are collapsed and transcended, right? In the natural world as we know it, the wolf and the lamb don't get on too well. But in this promised land, all this conflict somehow ends and there is a second innocence, right? The sense of the little child leading on this. So there's a newfound kind of knowledge which is also innocent. So my argument with the histories, and I'm going to look at four plays that somehow fit and belong to that pattern, is that Shakespeare creates a comedy about the home of the soul. And to interpret that, I think it's useful to think about each of the plays as having to do with England as a kind of macrocosm, a sort of mini-universe, right? And all the characters speak together the poem that is England. So you can't pick out any particular character and say, oh, well, he said this, but he said that. I think it's quite useful to try and hear the poetic kind of symphony of all the different voices, maybe not symphony, but more polyphony, all the different voices kind of speaking together, and try and receive that as a poetic whole. And from that sound, that poetic sound, we get the feeling of how it is with the soul of England, what's happening to England during these four plays that I want to briefly consider with you. And I'm looking at the cycle that begins with Richard II, goes through the two parts of Henry IV and ends with Henry V. If you can tell my hand's already doing this, right? So there's a sense of a sort of falling away from an original bliss and ending up in the wilderness, right, in a state of alienation, of hell, and something, some reversal of energy, pulls it out of that state. One last thing about that U-shape. The two points of the two extremes, the two extreme points of the U-shape are somehow not involved in history. They're kind of transhistorical. They're outside of time. They provide a symbol of origin and destiny, right? So that's the kind of general historical narrative I want to suggest that Shakespeare writes within. And already from Richard II, you've got this the speech by, I hope you know the play a little bit because I can't go into the story, otherwise we'll be here until tomorrow. But bear with me anyway, it'll become apparent. But there is this speech by John of Gaunt, the father of Bolingbroke, who is, of course, he's dying in Richard II. And before he dies, he wants to read young Richard the Riot Act, right? And tell him that he's been doing it wrong and that he's selling out England. I don't know if you remember that speech. It's a speech very often interpreted as a kind of jingoistic speech. Isn't it great to be English? But really, I feel that doesn't bear justice to the imagery. If we read just this little extract, of course, John of Gaunt says of himself before he dies, "Methinks I'm a prophet, new inspired, and thus expiring, dying, do foretell of him." So the prophetic voice is often the voice of the fall, isn't it? It's the voice of the moving away from the golden age. And so that's already, so Shakespeare's already suggesting something there for us. But when we read or hear his words, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself, against infection and the hand of war, so against conflict, a state of bliss without conflict. This happy breed of men, so a good society. This little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England. This is not the England of history, right? It's the blissful England of the imagination. It's the Garden of Eden as England. So there's already that sound, you see, in the play, and this sense that England is falling away from its origin. How is it falling away from its origin? How does it get to the wilderness? Well, in Richard II, there's a big pattern at play, because the concern is blood in Richard II. And I mean blood in the metaphorical sense of bloodline, right? So in the play, blood and name mean the same thing, right? Because name is title and blood is bloodline. But blood is also life, right? It's the life-giving thing. So somehow the bloodline, the name, is the being of the characters. They must have a name. It's fundamental that they have this name. And of course, there's a kind of principle in Shakespeare that whenever people are obsessed or characters are obsessed with metaphorical blood, physical blood gets spilt. Right? So this overwhelming concern with names and titles and bloodlines results in bloodshed, right? Civil war. Civil war is the symbol for wilderness and alienation. Right? And this is where Richard is taking us. But just to kind of illustrate that attachment to the names, when in the beginning of the play Richard banishes Mowbray and Bolingbroke because they've been hurling names at each other, Mowbray's reaction is, you have it in your copy, "The language I have learnt these 40 years, my native English, now I must forego. And now my tongue's use is to me no more than an unstringed viol or a harp, or like a cunning instrument cased up, or being open, put into his hands that knows no touch to tune the harmony. Within my mouth you have enjailed my tongue." And then he says to the king, "What is thy sentence then but speechless death, which rubs my tongue from breathing native breath?" Here, right, death is speechlessness. Right, because Mowbray is being taken away from his world of language, from his poem, if you will, right? He's been taken away from the community in which he has a name, and his name is his blood, is his life. And without that, and it's a key word in the play, he is nothing, right? So it's a speechless death is the result of banishment. Banishment, another very strong word, I think, in Shakespeare. And of course, this is another kind of Shakespearean thing that happens. If you know this play, you will know that it's an extraordinary, the language is extraordinarily mannered and full of extended metaphors and long rhetorical speeches and rhyming couplets, and you know, it's language is frolicking. And this is very much Shakespeare's way of evoking the medieval. And reality, or language and being, if you will, are close together. The names of things are the things themselves. Therefore, there's this beautiful, but somehow a little bit crystallized, kind of language that permeates the play. But what's amazing in Shakespeare is that he shows that this is happening so that people are speaking like this, but their actions do not reflect it, right? So there's a harmony in the language, but not a harmony in the being. In other words, even though language and being are said to be together, in reality, language and reality are beginning to be split. And if Shakespeare is a, I don't know about his political views. Many people think they do. I don't. But I do feel that in many of his plays, he is a critic of the feudal system. Right? Whereas as a poet, of course, he must be with the medieval worldview, because as a poet, of course, the word is the thing. You know? Why else would I write poetry? But the feudal system is an unjust system. There is a lack of justice. There's a lack of justice. And if you notice, in Richard II, nobody that doesn't have a name speaks. There's a couple of allegorical characters, but really, the subjects, right, the lowly people, they don't have a role at all in that world, right? So there's this sense of injustice. And this is John of Gaunt's complaint to Richard is, you have leased out the land. Landlord of England you have become, right? So in the name of having a name, right, the land is being parceled out unjustly, right? So injustice is what breaks apart language and being. Significantly, the only person that keeps changing name, or the only, forgive me, the only character that keeps changing name, I get so involved that I start seeing them as actual people, is Bolingbroke, right? Because Bolingbroke is the one that usurps the crown. And at the beginning of the play, he's Bolingbroke, then he's Derby, then he's Hereford, then he's Lancaster, and by the end of the play, he's King Henry IV. So he's kind of tearing through that still crystallized medieval worldview and changing things very, very quickly. And he really symbolizes the energy of the new kind of more modern man who's not in love with the power inherent in language itself, but appreciates the manipulative features of language, how language can give power. And for this reason, he's sparing with speech. He only speaks when he really has to, unlike Richard, who can't stop, right? So there's this speech when Bolingbroke is, usurping the crown effectively, and Richard is putting on a big show and a big scene. And so if you've got it on your copies there, Bolingbroke just says this one line. He's very much a one-liner king. Are you contented to resign the crown? You've been speaking for half an hour, right? And then Richard's response is very interesting. I know, for I must nothing be. It's so medieval, playing on words, playing on meanings. And that beautiful chiasmus, I know, no I, is a kind of image, right? It's a language that is an image of itself because it's a language that represents a big image, the big medieval worldview. But in this bit of the speech, it breaks apart. Therefore, no, he says, for I resign to thee. Now mark me how I will undo myself, how I will split my being. I give this heavy weight from off my hand, and this unwieldy scepter from, I'm sorry, from off my head, and this unwieldy scepter from off my hand. I've lost the next page. That's interesting, there's no page 8. It doesn't matter, I've got it right here. The pride of kingly sway from out of my heart. With mine own tongue deny my sacred state, with mine own breath release all duty's rights. Well, what's happening here? That tears and hands and tongue and breath are all physical things, things of the body. And balm, the balm of anointed kings, crown, the symbol of kingship, sacred state, duty rights are all symbolic things, things of the imagination, if you will. But he's breaking that apart by saying, I'm doing this. He's effectively disconnecting language and being. And this kind of, and thereafter he's nothing. He's got these kind of long meditations about, oh, there's page 8 now. That's great. Okay. Forgive me, I must just reorder my notes here, otherwise we'll be here a while. Right. So, this is a theme that continues in the next two plays. I think I probably must be brief. I could speak about it all day, really. But in Henry IV, part 1, this continues. And Bolingbroke, who becomes King Henry IV, is not a great king. He's called by others the unfirm king. The second word of the play, first part of Henry IV, is shaken, just like that. And he is the shaken king. He's always worried about something. He's firefighting. There's always a civil war. This set of rebels, now that set of rebels, and also I want to lead a crusade. He's moving about left, right, and center. And there's a feature of that play which is remarkable, the sense that neither he nor the rebels that are against him have a sense of time. And by time, I don't mean just the watch, but I mean a sense of appropriateness, a sense of when it is right to do something, a sense of the order of things and the order of actions. In other words, prudence, right? Practical wisdom seems to have vanished from the play completely. And therefore, everybody fails. Everybody fails because things always happen at the wrong time. Everybody fails, but there's one character who picks up this timelessness and revels in it. And if you look at the first lines from Falstaff, his very first line is, "Now, Hal, what time of the day is it, lad?" And Hal helpfully points out, what a devil hast thou to do with the time of day? Unless ours were cups of sack, and minutes capons, and clocks the tongues of boards, and dials the signs of leaping houses, and the blessed sun himself, a fair hot wench in flame-coloured taffeta. I see no reason why thou should be so superfluous as to demand the time of day. So he doesn't know the time of day because he follows his desires, right? All these things that Hal has pointed out to him are all the things that drive Falstaff, right? All the physical desires that he's after. It's an utter disorder, right? It's utterly timeless what he's doing. And he loves it. He doesn't need time. He doesn't need order. In fact, there's a line in the play where he actually says, I live out of all order, out of all compass. Right? So he says it. He tells us who he is very clearly in this play and even more the next. So this scene also ends with a remark on time, right? Time is also in the last line of this scene, where Hal, who is, of course, he's going to become Henry V, but he's the only one who seems to have a sense of the appropriateness of time is missing. And he says, When you know that everybody complains about him, don't you? Because he wastes his time with Falstaff, and he's always in alehouses and brothels and in this very dark, wild, hellish London that Shakespeare creates. But he says, never mind that, I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men least think I will. Now, redeeming time, right? The sense of the redemption of time. That means he understands what is needed, a new sense of appropriateness, a new concept of order, a new sense of prudence. Of course, it doesn't really happen in the play. And Falstaff, right, because this is the tragedy. We've got this magnificent knight, Hotspur, you know, who's in love with valor and honor and courage and deeds of chivalry, right? Completely feudally connected things, very medieval things. And he would have been a magnificent knight had there been a good king on the throne. But there isn't one. And so Hotspur's energy loses context. It doesn't have a world to play in. So his virtues become vices because there is no prudence. There is no there's no quality in England that can put these virtues into order. So his courage becomes rash. And the rasher he is, the more rash he is, the more easily manipulated. Right? His wicked uncle has just used a couple of rhetorical tricks here and there, and he's got Hotspur in his pocket. And with the death of Hotspur, and Hal, of course, is his shadow twin. They're both called Harry. There's so many things that are connected. They both marry a woman called Kate. It's very, very clear that, you know, Hotspur should have been Hal in some way. But with the death of Hotspur is the death of honor and the death of a sense, of an understanding of the virtues that belong to the soul. And Falstaff does this. I'm sorry if you like Falstaff. I really enjoy him as well. I think he's really funny. But really, he's the villain. Right? I'm arguing here that he's the real villain. And this is the speech that gives it away, which you've got there as well, about honor. And of course, he's on the battlefield at Shrewsbury. And they're telling him, come on, you know, go and fight. You know, you owe God a death. And he's like, oh, not today. No thanks, right? But then he says, well, 'tis no matter. Honor pricks me on. Yea, but how if honor prick me off when I come on? How then? Can honor set to a leg? No. By the way, this is a mock dialogue with the soul of the soul with itself. It's a parody of catechism, which is quite interesting. Can honor set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honor hath no skill in surgery, then? No. What is honor? A word. What is in that word honor? What is that honor? Air. A trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died on Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible then. Yea, to the dead. But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction, that's slander, will not suffer it. Therefore, I'll none of it. Right? So this started with Richard. This is the very end of the covenant between words and things, between words and qualities, between the word and the soul. Words are but air for Falstaff, and only sensible things count. And sensible things are of value insofar as they guarantee the two things he's interested in, survival and pleasure. Right? So he represents, if you will, the rise of the selfish nominalist, right? The self-interested gentleman that is actually the concern of so much 18th very much present in our culture. In this sequence of histories, he disappears, but with us, he hasn't gone yet. But the point is that he has said very clearly, you know, words that evoke qualities that are intangible are doing no such thing. It's just air. Those things don't exist. Yeah, so all these virtues that are intangible is just a word. There's no real thing, okay? So he, you know, it's very symbolic. He's the anti-poet. Okay? He's the anti-poet, but he's also the king of of reveling. He's the Pharaoh of Egypt, right? He's the Lord of the wilderness. He's the King of hell. And it is his quality, much more so than Bolingbroke, who's too busy fighting to be a king. It is his quality that rules England in this wilderness state at the bottom of the U-shape. And the next play, which I can only very briefly go over. In the next play, the next play is extraordinary. It's a mess of words. There are more insults in that Shakespeare play, I think, than any other. If you like insults, second part of Henry IV is your play, and there's some fantastic insults in there. But, the language works in two directions, either loads and loads of insults or proverbs and truisms, which is interesting, right? Because the people in that London, those that want to speak well, revert to words of the past, right? Truisms, proverbs. There's this phrase from Justice Shallow, good phrases are surely and everywhere very commendable. But they're from the past. What's happening right now is the total mess of language. It's language wild and unruly. It's Falstaff's language. And in fact, the play itself starts with the personification of rumor stepping onto the stage and saying, open your ears. For which of you will stop the vent of hearing? It's a very physical kind of a reductionist way of describing the ear there. When loud rumor speaks. So rumor is hearsay. It's false language. Yeah. But just the fact that Shakespeare begins with that kind of gives us the sense of what is going on. And of course, the rebellion gets beaten with a trick, right? A trick of John of Lancaster, who uses the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. So even there's a kind of disharmony between language and reality. But through all this, there's Falstaff's quarrel with the Chief Justice, which kind of rules the comedy and provides the energy of the play. Falstaff, there's so many things. I want to make this argument that he's the King of England. I passionately want to do it. And there's so many, I could try and convince you in so many ways, but we can't do it today. But just a couple of things that he says. I am not only witty in myself, but the cause that wit is in other men. In other words, how I think everybody thinks. I know that to be the case. He's the common sense voice, right? I know this to be true. At the end of the play, when his mate Hal finally gets the crown, he's so sure that this is going to be great for him. He has no question. And he actually says, if I could just find the right page... I have not the right page, but he says something like, the laws of England are at my commandment. Right? Who says something like that? A tyrant. Who else would say, the laws of England are at my commandment? There's some dreadful characters in Shakespeare that say exactly that. Goneril in King Lear says, the laws are mine. Yes? So there's that sense of the selfish, right? Laws are for the sake of selfishness. It's every man for himself, and the guy that gets to the top is the guy that rules the show. Right. So with this in mind, we can look at Hal's rejection of Falstaff in another way. It's not just a friend saying to another friend, I know thee not, old man. It's a reversal of energy. He must do this. The wrong king is sitting on the throne of England. Right? He must get the crown back from Falstaff, yes, and begin a kind of a redeeming, if you will, of England, away from this absolute wilderness where civil war reigns, towards a different sense of community. And now the play kind of tries, this is the next play, it's in Henry V, tries to go back up the U-shape. But now I really need the next page. It's funny how this happens. Twelve. Hey, here we go. That'll do it. Complete mess, much like the England in the wilderness. Good. Okay, so, the next play really has a different sound. So whilst the second part of Henry V, the fourth, starts with rumour saying, open your ears, I am false speech, I will guide you through the play. Henry V, first line, very famous, yes. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. It's not insignificant that the word ascend is in there. We can let that be, but there is a different quality to when Rumour was speaking, and now to the chorus is kind of declaiming these high poetic thoughts. But the heaven of invention. Invention, we started with a very poetic play which went wrong, which is Richard II. And of course, the poet here is asking for the muse to rise up to the heaven of invention. What is invention? It's imagination, right? He's asking for poetic imagination. In other words, he's asking for, in some way, a new relationship with speech is going to have to come into being. In this play, in order for the energy to be reversed. Invention is, the heaven of invention is the minding of true things that I was speaking about at the beginning of the play. Nevertheless, the play doesn't really do that. The first couple of acts have really, there's a lot of verbosity. I don't know if you remember the speech of the Archbishop of Canterbury talking about the Salic law, where he gives some obscure reason why Henry is allowed to go to war with France. It's one of Shakespeare's most boring, I think, but purposely so. It's very much to express the verbosity, right? Where you see language and being are so divided that now you've got these endless laws that you can use for your own benefit, and you can talk endlessly about things and somehow it makes it seem right, but it isn't. And both those guys, both the archbishops, are sophists. There's this, that speech about comparing England to the honeybees. I don't know if you remember that one. It's an obscure one. It's sophistry, right? So you've got language at the beginning of the play is still caught in that sort of hellish mode. But there is a counter, there's a counter energy in the play, which has to do with friendship, mentions of friendship. In the army, there's a Welshman and a Scot and an Irishman and an Englishman, and they can't quite understand each other. And then they kind of get into a bit of a debate and an argument. But always there's a character saying, "Be friends, right? Come on, we've got quarrels enough. Be friends." So there's a kind of sound of friendship running through the play. But I think it's not really until Act Three where we start to hear Henry as more of a philosopher. He's a great speaker. He can inspire others, but he also has these wonderful soliloquies. So if we just go to the very famous speech with this sort of St. Crispin's Day, where he's talking about, you know, the few of us against the mighty French and how we're going to remember this day forever. But there's this little bit of that wonderful, inspiring, you know, rhetorical speech, which is quite interesting. He's talking about how they will be remembered. And he says, "Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups, freshly remembered." This is the opposite to the names in Richard II. Here the names are familiar. Familiar as household words, and he calls himself Harry the King, not King Henry. "I am first Harry, but I just happen to be the King." So there's this sense of names become kinship. They cease to be a connection to a great political order that we belong to, and if you don't belong to it, you're nothing. Right? All of a sudden, there's a different relationship between the people of the kingdom. And he carries on. "This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin shall never go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered." Now, remember what I said at the beginning, talking about the U-shape, the two points of the U-shape, origin and destiny. Destiny is not a point in history, right? The ending of the world is not a point in history. It's not the end of history. It's the destiny of things, right? So when he refers to the ending of the world, he's talking about the revelation. He's talking about the promised land. He's talking about the apocalypse. And what is remembered in that symbol of destiny are not the deeds of history, but the spirit with which those deeds are performed. Not the deeds, but the spirit with which the deeds are performed. So that imagery, that symbolism is very, very much there. And what is that spirit with which the deeds are performed? Well, he says it. See, I'm going away from the jingoistic reading, very much so. Yeah? We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. The shedding of the blood is interesting because from something that divided everybody, bloodlines, it's now something that brings everyone together in this brotherly manner. And the gentling of the condition, of course, at a literal level, this just means, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a peasant, you'll have your place in this new society that we're creating. But gentling of the condition is kind of an altering of the being, in some sense. He's creating a condition in which there can be friendship, right? There's an overthrow here of the unjust landlord of England feudal system that has begun. And I'll just point out as an aside that in the Republic, right, whose theme is justice, Socrates can't carry on the inquiry until everyone is befriended. Yeah, he must befriend Thrasymachus in book one. He must do it. And if he can't do it, then the inquiry can't carry on. So friendship is a basic condition from which justice can grow. It's not just a system that you impose. Here's a just system, here you go. No, there must be friendship. There must be brotherhood for the country, for the land to be a home of the soul, to be just again. And of course, in the play, that gets played up again because the French are what England was in the world of Richard II. I love the scenes with the French because they're so overtly feudal. It's mentions of armors. It's talking about horses for 300 lines. It's deeds of chivalry. It's poems to the lady. And there's absolutely no mention whatsoever of the people, except this one line, which I particularly like. Our superfluous lackeys and our peasants. One mention of the French people, and that's the one. Right? So there's an So England, the little band of brothers, must overthrow the evil empire of the French, right? But the point is that on stage, this overthrow must be enacted. It's not enough for Henry to say it. It must be shown. And in this context, the French fulfill that symbolic function of the injustice that's been ruling the world of those four plays, finally overthrown. And as a result, now we're in pure comedy, yeah? Because after that overthrow, the play can move to Henry's disastrous wooing of Kate. I mean, he's a terrible lover. And he admits it himself. It's really funny, that whole bit. And when he tries to speak French, it's hilarious. So the play moves on to... I just want to, look at the final few words of the play, where the Queen of France says, God, the best maker of all marriages, combine your hearts in one, your realms in one, that English may, as French Englishmen, receive each other. God speak this, amen. Okay, so this is not just the union of two people in a sentimental sense, not just the union of marriage, but a greater union has been achieved. It is a trope of all comedies. That it's not just marriage, but usually an old law gets overthrown, an outdated kind of social structure gets overthrown, or some annoying old people get overthrown. But in each case, the symbol is the same. There's a new sense of union that has developed in the play. And in this case, right, we've got two realms in one, two hearts in one. So there's a very, very strong comedic symbol here at the very end of Henry V. We're outside of history here, right? We're talking about what all history ultimately points to, which is this second bliss, this promised land. So this reversal of energy that can aspire to a return to the promised land does not come about with the deeds of history, but because of the deeds of love. The one true trans-historical force in all of Shakespeare's plays. This radical transformation, miracle birth, divine gift, redemption, we can use any symbol we like, has a social force, right? As well as a personal one. And simply speaking, we're called upon to live together justly in friendship and with love. Portraying history as a divine comedy, Shakespeare understands and expresses how the energy of love is at work as an energy of a fundamentally different nature to the energy of conflict or history. And this promised land is also a promised union of deed and word, of speech and being, of language and world. But for this to occur, the relation between language and those who speak it must be just, unlike in Richard II, where it was unjust. Language must not be used for manipulation and conflict and the pursuit of one's own desires. It must not be reduced to a mere tool to generate socio-political controversy, indulge offense, and encourage incendiary critique as it is today. Today we are in the England of Bolingbroke. Language must be in a just relationship with creation. Only in this way does it become a vehicle for the reversal of energy and the return to the promised land. Thank you.
Well, thank you for a wonderful lecture, Valentine. Do we have some questions from the floor? Yes, lady there. Gentleman there, sorry. Yep.
Valentine, the Rome as a theme in Shakespeare's plays. We've spoken a lot about England. What about Rome?
How long have you got? Yeah, right. That's very interesting. I mean, I sort of have been looking at that recently. It's a whole different world. There's very much, I mean, in the Roman plays, there's the history of the decline of, well, actually, not necessarily the decline, but there are several sort of passing stages from kingship to republic and from republic to empire, where a kind of private citizenship kind of comes to the fore, as it were. It's really interesting because in Julius Caesar, this touches, in a way, Caesar is a great speech manipulator. He's a great rhetorician, and Mark Antony after him in that play. But they create this sense of, you see, at the beginning of the play, or at least at the end of Coriolanus, the Romans are republicans, so they have a relationship to language. They must speak together in order for Rome to flower. Yeah, I know. Yeah, but that's the ideal. Whether they do or they don't, actually they don't. But that's the ideal. That's at play. But Caesar overturns that because he creates himself into a kind of much higher than a republican politician. He's kind of a demigod in a way. And really, what he's saying to the citizens of Rome is, I'll look after the politics, you follow your private desires, right? And the rhetoric of the Roman plays is full of that, how people sort of get fooled by that. And in a sense, there's a sort of falling away, a passing away of the old world of the Republic, whether Greek or Roman. But that old sense of understanding society kind of dies away with a Julius Caesar play. So there's a kind of similarity of concern, but it's expressed very differently, and it's got a lot more to do with Roman rhetoric than this. This is a lot more poetical, I would argue. But there's a similar, thank you for raising that, because there's a similar kind of arc at play. He certainly, I would say, Shakespeare views universal history as having to do with the love revelation. So every time he touches on a historical subject, it's got to be about that ultimately. What are the conditions in society, what are the conditions in history that can receive the energy of love? I think all his more historical plays are a meditation on that. That would be my argument today, but you know, I'm still studying.
Do we have any more questions? Yes, David, there. So the question is, I have to repeat the question. The question is about how the redeeming of time is repeated throughout Shakespeare's plays. You've got two or three minutes to go on.
Thank you, yes. Thanks. That's a magnificent question.
Brilliant.
And I can't take it on because I would need to think about it, go away and think about it. I can certainly just about view it in the context of these four plays that we've looked at today, where time in Richard II had become frozen. The whole thing had become still and crystallized. And so that must fall away kind of lawfully. And the next couple of plays are without time. And mysteriously, time is linked to justice. That's what I learned in the context of these plays. But I just can't say for sure. I can't say for sure how Shakespeare kind of takes that on in the context of all of his plays. But now I'm going to go away and think about it. So thank you.
That's a
great question. Yes, of course. Yeah.
So probably a book there, I think.
Yeah.
Or a PhD. Next question. Yes. So paraphrase the question is, what happens next?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So that's a good question. I'm not looking at the 10 plays as a chronicle of history. I'm looking at those four plays as a comedy. And the quality of the Henry VI plays and what they suggest, I think, are of a very different order. I can sort of see the union between these four plays. And I'm suggesting the U-shape arc as a way of looking at it. I'm not saying that Shakespeare thought, you know what, I'll write four plays in a U-shape pattern. But I'm sort of looking at it to kind of draw out some key ideas within those four plays. And there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that he did think those plays roughly in a kind of continuity, even just chronological, but there's certainly some kind of cross-referencing between the plays anyway. But I don't think that Henry VI play continue that. And one of the ways that I would suggest that this is so is because clearly the end of Henry V is trans-historical. It just gets out of history altogether. Because, you know, if we have a king like that and this peace between England and France like that, we'll never have war again, right? So it's not historical, but it's a sort of, you know, super historical kind of suggestion. And I think that's on purpose. But yeah, I don't think it follows. And I'd need to think about those plays in answer to your question.
Any more questions from the floor? So following the pattern that you're suggesting that these plays follow, where are we now?
Yes,
Donald Trump.
Well, indeed. And Donald Trump and the kind of hold that the increasing hold that subtle forms of political correctness has on things. For me, we're in the second part of Henry IV. Where language is completely divorced from being, and therefore it's completely contentious. It's completely contentious, and incendiary kind of speech is the order of the day, because there's no relationship to anything real anymore. So we're at the worst bit, I'm afraid.
The only way is up.
I hope so, but someone's gonna have to banish Falstaff, because Falstaff is you know, we laugh at him and he's a fantastic character and I love him and all, but philosophically, he's at the heart of so much of our thinking, about politics, of our thinking about law, of our thinking about, you know, about education. He's everywhere. He really is the king. So we need to address Falstaff. We need to recognize him as more than a farcical character. He's actually a very strong philosopher, and he has a hold on us. So someone needs to banish him, in other words.
I think we've got time for perhaps one more, maybe two, we'll see. Aristotle? Yeah. So the question is the role of Hal in the play. How does he move from that Falstaffian view and world to the transfiguration of him as the king and his redemption?
Yeah, and there's a sort of paradox in that. I mean, he so offends that he makes offense a skill. There's a sort of... there's a kind of weird practical wisdom about him, because in a way, he is doing actually what his dad told him to do, which is foreign policy 101, which is take people's concerns away from the problems at home and let's all have a war with another power, and that will somehow unite people. And somehow, it's bad, right? And somehow it does. But I think the greater action of Henry is that, well, there's two things. He understands that nobility, the qualities that are nobility are not, are to do with nobility within. Yeah, there's a soliloquy, we didn't look at that today, but there's a soliloquy where he talks to himself and he says, what, you know, this kingship that has been so much a problem for England, it's ceremony, right? It's just place and form and people adoring. But saying that is a kingly utterance, you see, recognizing the limitation of this kind of power structure, as it were, that he's been involved in, and kind of seeing it for what it is a kingly utterance, and so there's a sort of honesty and integrity that's at play within him, and a simple concern for friendship and brotherhood amongst his people. In a way, the simple values, essential things on which, you know, how can we talk about justice? How can we create a just England unless we're friends? Unless there's a condition to speak together. Of course, when language is at its most contentious and incendiary, there is no friendship. It's just people hurling insults at each other and shouting at each other, which is exactly what it is today in so-called debates, right? So there are some basic human conditions that must be reawakened in order for a true speech between the people in the society to take place. And I think Hal is not a great philosopher, but I think that's his insight. So it's a very diluted form of love, but it is love nonetheless, and that is what sort of moves things forward, rather than sophistication or political machinery.
I think we've got time for just one quick question. There's a lady over here, just last one. So how does the vision of the play that you're arguing towards, how is that substantiated by the time Shakespeare lived in? Was he seeing that in his time? Or, I think, just to paraphrase you, is it something more in a mythical dimension?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's the short answer, is I think it's something more in a mythical dimension. But it's. I mean, I think if he saw anything in his day, it's more of a Falstaff character than a. I mean, you know, people like, I don't know, Francis Bacon and Hobbes, where he's pretty much his contemporaries, and they were thinking very much closer to a Falstaff understanding of society than the mythical thing that he's suggesting. So if anything, those energies were very much on the rise. But I think he was interested in really what poetic imagination can reveal about these things. And I think he was very serious about that. I think it's a very genuine attempt to hold the imaginative mirror up to nature and try and show something that too much concern with the daily things, with the little events, with the mockeries, can't reveal. So I know there was, you know, there were ideas about the myth of Elizabeth, and perhaps there was that. I don't know. I'm not an expert on those things. But I think he, I would suggest he saw through human beings a lot more than that, than just subscribe to some political maneuver of the time. That's just a suggestion. I haven't asked him, but that's just an idea.
We are dead on 15 past when we must finish. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want to thank you very much for coming this evening and supporting this event. I think Temenos is something very, very special, and you know, it's wonderful that you're all here this evening. I hope that I've done Kathleen justice. I almost feel her looking at me. And Valentine, you certainly have. It was a wonderful lecture, and thank you, everyone. Thank you very much. Thank you.